Hi, I'm Stephanie Potter with KBOO Radio. This is the Recovery Zone, where we talk about people and organizations who are doing what they can to help heal our world. And my guest today is Zoe Weil. She's all the way from Surrey, which is on the coast of Maine, and she's a co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education and the author of a number of books, including, above all, Be Kind and The Power and Promise of Humane Education. Her most recent book is called Most Good, Least Harm. And Zoe, I just want to welcome you here to KBOO.
Thank you so much, Stephanie.
I'd like to start just with the word that I see over and over again when I was reading your book. It was the word MOGO. Could you just tell us what MOGO means?
Sure. MOGO is short for Most Good, which is short for Most Good, Least Harm, which is, of course, the title of my book. And it's also the principle by which I live. And MOGO is just a short way of saying it because Most Good, Least Harm is kind of a mouthful.
And so you don't even bother with the least harm part of it. You just stick with the most good.
I know, that's awfully positive thinking, isn't it? But MOGO just feels easy for me to think of as a term for how can I make choices that do the most good and the least harm to myself, to other people, to animals, and to the environment. So I can just ask myself, okay, what's MOGO here? What's the most good choice?
Every time you make a choice, you're sort of clicking off all those four things in your mind.
Yes. I mean, I'm not robotic about it, but I do think of my choices in that way. And choices, everything from what I eat to what I wear to what I purchase, the products I use, to how I'm going to be involved in volunteerism, what work I'm going to do today, what I'm going to focus on, what is my life's work, what forms of activism can I participate in, how can I be more involved in democracy. I'm always in the back of my mind thinking, what's going to be MOGO? What's going to do the most good and the least harm?
And so what are these again? It's for other people, for myself, for the environment, and for animals.
Yep, that's
okay.
It.
Over and over and over again. So what actually got you then to write this book? This has been your life's work, in a sense?
It has. I've been a humane educator for about 25 years, and a humane educator is somebody who teaches about the interconnected issues of human rights, environmental preservation, animal protection, and then issues of culture, like how we determine our values and belief systems and globalization and all sorts of interconnected issues that relate to the choices that we make. So humane education explores all this in an effort to help people make choices that are MOGO, that choices that do the most good and the least harm. And so I've been doing this work for a long time, and I often would ask students, what does the most good and the least harm between a couple of different choices. So I might have a styrofoam cup and a ceramic mug, or I might have a cloth diaper and a disposable diaper, any number of choices. And after years of asking that question, I realized that that concept had actually become the guiding principle of my own life. And so while I was teaching young people for many years, I began to see this as a really important initiative in education that many more teachers should be using as a guideline. So I wrote a book for educators. That's The Power and Promise of Humane Education. I wrote a book for parents, Above All, Be Kind, to help them raise their own children with these values. And I wrote some books for kids. And then I decided I needed to write a book for the general public about this principle and how to put it into practice in your life. And it seems like such an easy, basic principle. Why can't we all just put this into practice simply? But it's actually quite challenging to do so.
And maybe you could talk about that. What makes it so challenging?
Sure. Well, where I live in rural Maine, 100 years ago, anybody would know where most of their food came from, where most of their clothes came from, where the building materials came from for the house they were living in, where their transportation came from, where their heat source came from, because it was local and everybody could see the impacts of their choices on others. But now in this globalized world, we have no idea where our products come from, our foods come from, our clothes come from, the building materials come from, our electricity comes from. We just don't know. And because we lack that knowledge, it's very difficult to make choices that our MOGO because we don't have the information. So that's the first challenge.
I think another part of that might be we also don't know what the effects are. Like for years, we were all driving our cars not realizing we were making the planet heat up.
Exactly. Whereas if you ride a bicycle 100 years ago, you pretty much can figure out those effects. They're much simpler. Now, we didn't know everything 100 years ago by any means in terms of the impacts of our choices, but we knew a lot more. It's much more challenging now to gain the knowledge. The second big challenge is that it's not just that we don't have the knowledge. We often lack the will to get the knowledge. And why do we lack that will? Because it's hard work to seek out that knowledge. It's hidden. It's circuitous. It travels around the globe. It's very difficult to find it
and
out.
And people will dispute you. Global warming does exist.
Yep,
global warming doesn't
absolutely
exist.
And not only is it difficult, but if you find out that your favorite foods, your favorite clothes, or whatever it is, your favorite car, if you find out that there are problems with those choices because they cause excessive destruction, or they cause undue suffering, or they cause some problem, well, then you're faced with a tough choice between your desires and your values. So for a lot of people, it's easier not to look, not to open those doors to gain the information, because doing so might elicit a conflict between values and desires. And if you choose your desires over your values, then you're living without integrity. And nobody wants to live without integrity. We want to be people of integrity. So often it's easier not to know. So first challenge is lack of knowledge. Second challenge is that we may lack the will to gain the knowledge. And the third challenge is that there's so many systems in place that we are complicit in, that we didn't create, that we may not want to be complicit in, but that cause suffering and destruction. So, for example, I wrote my book on my laptop. Now, my laptop is filled with chemicals that were mined in unsustainable ways. It's filled with toxins. It may have been produced overseas in a sweatshop. When its brief life is over, if I send it off for recycling, it may be disassembled by children working in another sweatshop being exposed to all those toxins. Now, none of that is something that I want to be complicit in, but I needed a computer in order to produce this book. So,
although you could have used an old typewriter.
I could have, but it actually would have been really challenging to even get a publisher to read it that way. Publishers now, agents now, they read everything electronically, you know. Also, the time it would take me to do it that way, would my time be better spent if I were to be promoting these ideas and get them out faster? I mean, there's all sorts of challenges here. But even if there was an alternative to my computer, there are not alternatives to many, many things that I participate in and that all of us participate in that are systemically causing problems. So the third challenge is these systems, which means that we need to meet these challenges by gaining the knowledge, by exerting our will to gain that knowledge, and by working to change those systems.
So we're not just changing what we do, we're changing what entire systems are doing.
Right.
That's a big lot of work to do, but you have seven keys in your book.
I do.
They kind of guide us through this, basically, right?
Yes. And these aren't seven keys that are hard and fast and you have to follow these keys in order to make MOGO choices by any means, but they're tools. They're things that I have found that have helped me to make choices that do the most good and the least harm.
Well, let's just have you talk about some of these keys then. For instance, what's the first one all about?
The first key is to live your epitaph. Now, what does that mean? Well, most of the time we don't write our epitaphs, right? Somebody else writes it for us when we die, or they write our obituary, or they say our eulogy. And hopefully we've lived a good life and they have something really positive to say about us. But what would happen if we were to each write our epitaph right now? And not to say that you write it only once, but you start and you actually think about what would you like said about you when you die? What would you like your life to have meant? What would you like to have contributed? And if you take the time to think about that and to write it down, then it gives you more of an opportunity to actually put it into practice, to live it now, so that when you do die, you will have lived your life the way you wanted to live it without just succumbing to all of the distractions and the currents and the ebbs and flows of life, which take us in different directions less consciously than sitting down and thinking, what do I want my life to be about? So that's the first key.
I just want to take a moment to let our listeners know you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I'm speaking with Zoe Weil, author of Most Good, Least Harm, A Simple Principle for a Better World and Meaningful Life. And so as you've been saying, these principles include seven keys. And the second key has to do with creating joy in our lives?
The second key is to pursue joy through service. Now, why did I even have this idea of pursuing joy as a key to living a life that does the most good and the least harm? Well, a couple reasons. First of all, I think that we are part of the equation. This isn't all about doing the most good and the least harm for everybody else, for other people, for other species, and for the environment. It's also about doing what's most good and least harmful to ourselves. And it's really important to lead joyful lives to the greatest degree possible. But that's not the only reason. The other reason why I have this key in there is that as an activist and a change maker and somebody who's been working to change different problems and atrocities in the world, I've had my own share of anger and rage at the terrible, terrible cruelty and destruction that's perpetrated on this planet. And I've also felt despair about that. And working with other activists, I've encountered the same feelings of anger, rage, despair, sadness. And the problem is that if you're trying to change things and what you're feeling is anger, rage, despair, and sadness, you're probably not welcoming too many people to join your club, because who wants to be around rageful and despairing people? It's really important that we find ways, if we want to change the world and expose ourselves to some of the problems, which is seeking out knowledge, it's really important that we find ways to be joyful, because then our enthusiasm, our excitement, our hope, and our joy are going to be infectious, and other people are going to want to join us, and then we create a better world. It's a win-win. So the reason why pursuing joy is so important is because it's clearly MOGO. It works for the world. It works for us. And the reason why the key is to pursue joy through service. I actually originally thought it was going to be two separate keys. One would be pursue joy and one would be of service. But I did this very unscientific survey. I asked hundreds of people, but mostly people who I knew through my email contacts, what brings you joy? And I got all of these incredibly beautiful responses back. And so many of the people wrote about being of service, being helpful to others, participating in something that does good in the world, that actually brought extraordinary joy into these people's lives. So I realized this was one key, and just a beautiful key, right? Because if we can pursue joy through service, we experience joy. The world appreciates everything that we give.
Like generosity itself brings a sense of happiness to people.
Yes, exactly. Kind of. Yeah. So the next key three, is to make connections and self-reflect. And what do I mean by that? That means that you're seeking out the knowledge to make the connections between your choices and their impacts in the world. So everything from the connections with the food you eat, to the clothes you wear, to the way you interact with people, all sorts of connections. How can we do that?
So this is sort of the inquiry part again.
Exactly. And making connections is actually both challenging and really fun to do, because gaining knowledge is satisfying. It's rewarding. So what do I mean by doing it? Well, let's say you are in your house right now listening to this. Open your refrigerator. Open your closet door. Open your medicine chest and pick an item that's sitting there and ask questions about it. Who was affected by it? What were the positive and negative effects by this item that you've just chosen on yourself, other people, animals, and the environment? What other choices might do most good or least harm than the one that you've picked? Now, how are you going to find this information out? Well, the internet gives us incredible resources for finding out information. Let's say you have gone into your medicine chest and you've found some toothpaste. Well, you can go to responsibleshopper.org and you can type in that toothpaste and you can find out a lot of information about it. And there are many websites that will help you to find out information about the effects of this choice, the ingredients in it, whether it's tested on animals, what were the conditions of the workers who produced it, all sorts of things like that. So that's what I mean by making connections. Now, once you make connections, you need to reflect upon that. And that's where the self-reflection part comes in. If you introspect about your choices and your values, then you can find where the confluence of your choices and your values meet. And then you can make perhaps different choices, or perhaps you'll get involved in some sort of change making to improve the conditions for the people who worked to produce that product or that food.
Again, making changes in the systems.
Yes.
And I'm kind of interested again in this whole true value thing, because one thing that people might object to is, well, this toothpaste might not be so great, but it's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
So how do you address this?
Right. And there are always going to arise conflicts between what we think is most good for us and what we think is most good for other people or other species or the environment. Conflicts arise. But that's why looking holistically at all of these categories helps us to at least make wiser choices or more informed choices and not succumb to black and white thinking. So, for example, yes, there could be one toothpaste that's a lot cheaper that comes from a big multinational that may test its product on animals and use less natural ingredients than, let's say, a toothpaste that comes from a different, smaller company or eco-friendly company. But if money is our real concern, there's always the option of just using baking soda and water, which is very inexpensive and cleans your teeth. And so there are many options out there. And the one thing that I really like about this principle is that it's not prescriptive. It doesn't tell people what choices they should make. It invites them to ask questions so that they can then make more informed choices that are in line with their own values. But it's not going to tell you what toothpaste to use or what food to eat. It's just going to ask you to ask the right questions so that you can determine that for yourself in a way that lets you live with integrity.
Mm-hmm. And I was talking earlier with you about the idea that my brother who lives in Germany is someone that if I want to see him, I have to fly mm-hmm. across the ocean. You know, something that tugs at my heart versus, you know, I know that planes do a terrible thing to the environment. You have to really weigh this stuff mm-hmm. back and forth is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And that actually jumps ahead to key 7, which is to strive for balance. And I know I haven't said what keys 4, 5, and 6 are
yet.
Okay.
Hopefully we can get to them all.
key 7 is to strive for balance. I mean, none of us can make perfect choices. And so we find that balance and then we live with it. But if we are making choices that stem from bringing what I call our three I's, our inquiry, our introspection, and our commitment to integrity, if we bring that to our lives, we can live with ourselves. And the subtitle of the book is A Simple Principle for a Better World and Meaningful Life. And that's what this is about. It's about contributing to a better world and also living really meaningful lives.
And the idea of meaning being that important to us.
Absolutely.
Like meaning being more important than, I really want to eat 10 bowls of ice cream tonight or something.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, I think that we crave meaning in our lives. And a lot of the depression that people suffer from is a lack of meaning and purpose. And we have a lot of problems in our world. And the effort to make a difference brings extraordinary people into our lives and enriches our lives in immeasurable ways and adds so much meaning. And I think that that meaning leads to joy.
And something that's going on in our culture a lot is this idea that joy comes from consumer pleasures, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And what you're talking about is deeper joy, the joy of generosity or service, the joy of meaning.
Right. Pleasure and joy are different things. You know, pleasure is usually time sensitive, right? You know, you find it pleasurable to eat chocolate mousse, let's say. And you might find it pleasurable to watch your favorite TV show. And then the show is over. And you might find an addictive quality to seeking pleasure. I mean, we are pleasure-seeking people.
You want to watch another movie.
Right. Or you want another dessert or whatever it is. And joy is very different. Joy really infuses our whole being. And it is not related to the acquisition of things. Things don't tend to bring us joy. Relationships bring us joy. Experiences in nature bring us joy. Or, as I said before, service brings us joy. And I often tell the story about how I experience a lot of joy when I'm teaching young people. Mm-hmm. And I volunteer to do that in schools and where I live. And I was teaching a week-long course, humane education course on these issues that we're talking about to eighth graders. This was a couple years ago. And I had shingles at the time. Shingles are really, really painful. And when I walked in to teach the class, I walked in so much pain. But as I was teaching, the pain completely vanished. I was utterly pain-free. I mean, much better than morphine, you know, completely pain-free while I was teaching. And then when I left, the pain came back, right back. As soon as I closed the door, the pain was there. It was really fascinating to me that my being of service, my being in that place of joy, which I am when I'm teaching young people, not only is good for them, it's not only good for me because I'm in a state of joy. It was actually a pain reliever. And that really surprised me.
Yeah, amazing. This is Stephanie Potter. I'm speaking with Zoe Weil, whose most recent book is called
most good, least harm.
And as we've mentioned a few times, it's not just about doing something for ourselves. It's also about doing something to make the whole world a better place. It's about, as we've said, changing systems.
Right. Well, that's what key four is. So maybe I'll jump in with
okay,
key four.
Go for it.
So key four is to model your message and work for change. Now, you'd think that those would be two separate keys because they sound pretty different, but I actually see them as two sides of the same coin. So what do I mean by model your message? Well, Mahatma Gandhi was once asked by a reporter, what is your message? Now, here was a guy with a big message about freeing his country from British rule using only nonviolent means. But the way he responded to that reporter was to jot down on a piece of paper, my life is my message. Well, the truth is that each one of our lives is our message. Whether we like it or not, our life is our message. So the choices we make and the way we treat others and everything from the foods we eat to the work we do to the volunteerism to our participation in democracy, it's all our message. And, you know, even whether, you know, we tailgate somebody and honk at them, you know, that's part of our message. So the question is, are you modeling the message that you want to model? And that's a really important question because that's integrity. That's walking your talk. But that in and of itself is not quite enough because we have so many dire problems, whether it's global warming or it's escalating worldwide slavery or it's institutionalized animal abuse. We have enormous problems. So while modeling your message makes a huge difference and is really important, it isn't enough. At the same time, we have to work for change. We have to change those systems that are perpetuating, escalating slavery or institutionalized animal abuse or global warming. We have to change those systems. And each one of us has our own passions, the things we care about, and we also have skills and we have ideas. We're an incredibly creative species. Everybody listening to this program has an idea and is a creative being who could harness that creativity and that passion to actually work toward change.
Yeah, each of us living up to our full potential. And it's interesting to imagine if these values of MOGO dominated our culture, what things would be like?
Oh, wouldn't that be incredible? I mean, wouldn't it be incredible if corporations, if governments, if individuals, if educational systems had as their guiding principle, okay, what can we do that's going to do the most good and the least harm to ourselves, to other people, to other species, and to the environment? What can we do to make that happen? And if that really were our guiding principle, things would be so different. I mean, right now, corporations, the bottom line is the bottom line. That is the guiding principle. How can we increase money for our shareholders? And not how can we make choices that do the most good and the least harm? Now, I'm not suggesting that increasing profits for your shareholders isn't a good thing, but it should be one part of the equation, not the whole thing.
And what's your vision of how the whole world would look if it was a most good, least harm world?
Well,
Would we all be vegans?
I don't know. I don't know what people, I mean, it depends on where people lived, what they would choose to eat. I mean, I've chosen to eat a diet that is plant-based, is vegan, and I try to eat as much local as possible. But I'm not going to tell people exactly what diet is MOGO. People have to figure that out for themselves based on where they live and all sorts of other considerations. I've discovered that for me, that's what I believe is MOGO. But what would this world look like? Well, often when I do workshops, I ask people to envision the world when they're very old and that they're at the end of their life. And I ask them to imagine that in this world, there's no more war. War is only a word that we see in history books. It's not one we see in newspapers. There's no more genocide. People don't go to bed hungry. Well, unless they forgot to have dinner, but not because they're starving. And we've solved our problems to a great degree. And that means that we're not institutionalizing, abusing animals anymore. And it means that our air is clean and our water is clean. And one of the things I ask them to imagine is that they dip their mug into a nearby stream and they take a drink. And a lot of people find that preposterous. I mean, people roll their eyes at the very thought that we would ever do that. But of course, that's what we did for the vast majority of our history. Yeah, millions of years. I mean, maybe we didn't dip a mug because we might not have had a mug, but we'd certainly dip our hands and take a drink. That's what we did. Why can't we go back to that? Of course we can. We are an incredibly innovative, creative species. If that's what we want, we can get there.
And
part of this is to work with other people who are
that's
working
right.
for change.
And that's key five, which is to find and create community. And fortunately, in the Portland area, there's just incredible opportunities for creating community here and getting involved. And it's really hard to do any of this by yourself, to be the only person you know who cares about an issue and trying to make different choices that are out of the mainstream. That's really challenging. So it's really important to find and create community.
And you have a lot of tips and examples in the book. There's a whole chunk about food, a whole chunk about work, a
right.
whole chunk about activism. So do you have like websites and things that people would get into? To
oh, absolutely. Oh, the third section of the book is getting started, and that's where all the resources are, websites, books, films. And the easiest way for somebody who doesn't have the book to access that is to go to the website of the organization I co-founded, the Institute for Humane Education, because all of the websites in the book are linked there. And that website is www.humaneeducation.org.
And maybe you could say just a little more about the Institute?
Most of what we do is we train people to be humane educators who can talk about all of these issues I've just talked about in age-appropriate ways to students across the spectrum of their learning and in alternative settings, because we believe that these concepts and these ideas need to infuse education. In fact, we believe that the very purpose of education should be to provide students with the knowledge, the tools, and the motivation to be solutionaries for a better world. That it's not enough that they be verbally, mathematically, and technologically literate, and that they have jobs. They need to be change makers in those jobs who contribute to system changes that create a better world. So that's what we do at the Institute. And we have online courses. We have a humane education certificate program. We have the first Master of Education program that focuses on humane education in the United States. We do workshops all over the country. So if anybody is interested in learning more about that, they can go to our website, which again is www.humaneeducation.org.
Mm-hmm. And that's it's a definitely good place to go. Your book is called Most Good, Least Harm. And I just want to say once again, I've been talking with Zoe Weil. She's from Surrey, Maine, and she's been spending her whole life, it sounds like, trying to save the world, finding a path that really seems to work for her and that she thinks would work for a lot of other people.
I hope so. I can't say I've spent my whole life, but once I started finding out the problems in the world, I did feel like I needed to do something about them. And if only to diminish my own rage and sadness, I had to do something. And I think Joan Baez said it best when she said, action is the antidote to despair.
Action, the antidote to despair. And that's pretty much what a lot of our listeners are into. And so I just want to thank you for being here.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, and wish you much success.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone. You'll be able to find it archived on the kboo.fm website. And you're tuned to KBOO Portland. Thanks for listening.